The classroom interrupts the normal patterns of activity, specifically with regard to being online, creating and consuming content. Conversations in the classroom gum up the works.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer Chris Schaeberg about his book, Pedagogy of the Depressed, published by Bloomsbury Academic. One English professor's journey through the sometimes depressing landscapes of higher education and the collective joys and hopes of working with colleagues and students as they navigate technology and learning in an uncertain world.
So we might change our perspectives, think differently, get stumped. So we might experience a pedagogy of the depressed.
Let's talk pedagogy with teacher and writer Chris Schaeberg. On Arts and Letters.
The depression I am interested in tracking in this book is not so much an individual experience, not located, at least not solely, in the depressed subject. It's a state of things. It's a depressed atmosphere, a dispersed feeling of dread and weariness that has as much to do with cultural forces and planetary circumstances as it has to do with the intense feeling of solitary helplessness.
High hopes, keep having high hopes, even when you wanna hang your head down low, big dreams, keep having.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with teacher and writer Chris Schaeberg about his book, Pedagogy of the Depressed, and what constitutes, in this land of decoding screens, depression and hope in higher education.
The depression becomes something that's really kind of constant and low grade and collective. And that's really what I was trying to wrestle with this book, was that kind of collective depression that was really hard to pinpoint in one place or in one person's experience.
Open hearts, keep having open hearts, find the space for compassion. Let's grow from the start, evolving minds. Keep evolving minds. Don't let interpretation leave intention behind. What is the end goal? How do we get there?
Pedagogy of the Depressed poses many questions. How? In this technological-driven world, might we enact what Paulo Ferreira, in his book Pedagogy of the Oppressed, imagined as reading and writing the world?
Just that word pedagogy, do you see it as all those things? Object, subject,
yes.
Theory?
A collective atmosphere, built space, unbuilt space. Reception, receptivity, yeah. But I mean, this is the thing, right? This is why, partly why I wrote this book, is because I would wake up every night and I'd just be mulling over these things. It's like, I got to put this stuff together as a book because that's the only way I'm going to get it out of my system. Do we as a culture, you know, do we believe in higher education in a way that lets learning happen and learning kind of occur in ways that are often indeterminate or in ways that we just can't always map out?
What does it mean to teach with Zoom and asynchronous classrooms beckoning? What do we make of our current learning management systems and the anxious and often depressing possibilities ahead for higher education? How do we read our higher educational landscape in the midst of our post-pandemic response, in light of the collective trauma we've all been through? Let's go to college with English professor Chris Schaeberg. And consider and reconsider higher education, its depressing realities and hopeful possibilities on Arts and Letters.
Christopher Schaeberg, Pedagogy of the Depressed, editor, writer, teacher. Welcome to Arts and Letters.
Thanks so much for having me. I hope I can still teach. I'm not so sure anymore these days.
You know, I haven't really, with Arts and Letters, done a book on pedagogy. And although this is a kind of book on pedagogy, it's not a book on methods. But it alludes to probably one of the most famous theoretical books that pedagogues know, or one of them at least, called Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire. And in that book, he talks a little bit about reading the world and being of and in the world and having his students kind of read and understand the world. So I'm going to ask you a big question. So do you have your thinking cap on?
Let me find it. Okay. Go for it.
All right. So how would you currently read our world in terms of pedagogy?
Wow, that is a big and complex question. I mean, on the one hand, we have more teaching tools and more avenues for education, or I guess it's increasingly being called upskilling, as I'm hearing it in meetings these days. But on the other hand, there are these dearths of attention, time, kind of emotional wherewithal to absorb new knowledge, new ideas, maybe radical ideas. So my sense over the last several years, acceleratingly, has been that these two things are on a collision course. The abundance of tools and techniques and media forms on the one hand, and on the other hand, the scarcity of embodied capability to do more.
So where did the idea come from for the title, and also just the idea of stressing the end point of this, which would be the depressed, right? Pedagogy of the Depressed, as opposed to being oppressed.
Pedagogy of the Oppressed was one of the early texts that I stumbled upon when I was in grad school. I just stumbled upon a copy in a used bookstore. And I remember leafing through it and just sort of latching on to what felt very intuitively right to me about the radical potential for education. But then it kind of sat on my shelves, and I have not done anything with that book formally. But when I started writing more and more essays about teaching, I hit upon that punning title. And yes, I searched around. There were some great academic articles that used that title with a subtitle, but I couldn't find a book with that title. And so I thought, oh, come on. And just by coincidence, my publisher, Bloomsbury, happens to be one of the main publishers of Pedagogy of the Oppressed. So I asked my editor, do you have one of these in the works? And he said, no. And he said, I kind of like the idea. Let's go with it. So then things started falling into place with that. But it is a title that I feel a little leery about looking back at, because I know that I'm in some ways evading the pun, even as I'm
punning,
sort of playing.
Even as you're punning.
Yeah. The answer lies waiting if we listen. Who will be beside us? Will words and terms divide us? Will history just repeat itself again?
I get it, because, you know, you're taking on a big subject when we think of radical pedagogy or ways of thinking about pedagogy. But Freire's concept essentially was, well, one of them, in that a piece, and it, you know, it's a book, but it's also widely distributed sections from the book in education classes. And one is the idea of the banking concept of education, right? Where in the old days, the teacher stands up there and reads from his yellow notes, or the professor, and the students dutifully take down the notes and then spit them back to the teacher, who in some ways assesses them and determines how close it is to his ideological view of the world. But another element of this is also the idea of the individual and the collective, or the passive and the active,
mm-hmm.
or the discussion and the lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's neat in this book because I think you really tacitly and untacitly take on those themes, this notion of antipathy.
Yeah.
Where am I in these between times?
Right.
Where am I in relation to online, synchronous or asynchronous education and hanging out with folks and having a conversation, which is kind of what you've always wanted to do? You know, we can't go back. You and I've talked about this. But where are we in relation to this idea of what we were as teachers, which has drastically been changing?
Right.
But really, there was a forced change and then a hyper extension of that. So help me with what I would argue is a kind of antipathy, which is, you know, your mixed feelings about these modalities. Where do you stand with our brave new world in pedagogy?
I wish I could say, honestly, I wish I had a confident assessment or a feeling of being pulled strongly in one direction or another. You know, like, no, I'm doubling down on the in-person seminar and that's final. And I'm going to make in-person participation 50% of my grade. There's part of me that sometimes feels pulled that way. But on the other hand, you're right. We're not going back. And to think that we can just resurrect or reclaim that traditional classroom space, I think, is a fantasy at best. So then we have to engage with these new technologies, these new spaces, these new immensely distracted and distracting times that all of our students find themselves in while also in class, while also earning their degrees. I don't know. I'm profoundly confused and uncertain. I mean, I'm being really honest with you. I do not know. And I don't feel like I can just double down on any of my pedagogical staples.
There's a better day ahead. We'll find the answers we've been searching for but missing. There's a new song breaking dawn. The key to hearing it is just to listen, listen.
Despite the drudgery of committee meetings and seeing higher education shift into something else entirely, one of the reasons I've loved my job for the past 20 years is that I cherish the ineffable experience of being in the classroom with students while learning is happening in real time. There's nothing quite like asking a student to read a poem aloud, letting the words reverberate in the classroom for a few awkward moments, then asking another student to read the same poem aloud, again. More awkward silence. We look around the room. Then, wait for it, discussion erupts.
There's a better day ahead. We'll find the answers we've been searching for but missing. There's a new song breaking dawn. The key to hearing it is just to listen.
This is Jay Bradley Minnick. You're listening to Arts and Letters. We'll be back in a moment.
Listen.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with teacher and writer Chris Schaeberg as he talks about his book, Pedagogy of the Depressed.
Handwriting and terrible script written in real chalk on a blackboard. Awkward lapses after a question has been raised. Writing together in the moment on pieces of paper. These things feel clumsy and slow compared to the digital educational utopia, compared with the little rectangular supercomputers in our pockets, compared with the procedural sublime of online interfaces and their promises of data-driven achievement and clear measurability.
Sometimes I feel like I'm speaking into darkness, but I know somewhere
lifted from the unknown. I believe we'll get through this, I just don't know how yet. I try to stay calm, but I'm a nervous wreck. The weight of it all keeps pulling me under, and I can't quite breathe, but I'm holding on.
But there's something profoundly humbling about being in a classroom with other learners and with a teacher actually learning. At its best, it's always an experience of venturing into the unknown.
What feels like falling now will make sense with time. I know you're scared, I'm here too. I haven't found the way, but I'm closer than before. Take a step back.
There's really no map for it, no way to measure it in the moment. It's an ineffable yet crucial part of the learning experience. And it's something that online learning platforms and smartphones mitigate, if in competing ways. The classroom interrupts the normal patterns of activity, specifically with regard to being online, creating and consuming content. Conversations in the classroom gum up the works, so we might change our perspectives, think differently, get stumped. So we might experience a pedagogy of the depressed.
I believe we'll get through this, I just don't know how yet. I try to stay calm, but I'm a nervous wreck.
And I'll kind of bring up another pedagogue, but, you know, Vygotsky would suggest this notion of the tool. The notion of technology, I understand it, the commodification, the concern, the looking at the screens, the way it can depress us. But, you know, Vygotsky often talked about the notion of the tool. I see a lot of this work that we're able to do as tools. We could, you know, ultimately just imagine the classrooms as they were. But now, after having taught, as you have a lot, synchronously with students, these tools are pretty helpful in some ways, too, and not so helpful. Thoughts about the benefits of the technology?
I have been pleasantly surprised to see the range of students who participate and how they participate as we embrace and adapt with these new tools. That's been illuminating to me, because I think in the before times, it was like being a good student was very clear to me, and there were about two or three ways to do it. And now it's like I see six or seven or eight ways that students can be good students because they have these different tools and they can express themselves in multiple ways, not just by being in the class and looking alert and excited about what we're reading. If that makes sense.
It does. So how would you say these tools, you know, and I think of the tool, the idea of the tool is a metaphor that shapes us and helps us understand and maybe fulfill a kind of task or a kind of activity or a kind of way of being. How would you say these tools are and have been creating a kind of depression in our students?
Yeah, the sheer abundance of them, right? I mean, I've seen, for instance, on our single sign-on website for our students and faculty, you know, at first there were three or four little tabs that you could click on, right? There was Blackboard, and there was the enrollment management system, and there was, maybe there was one for financial aid or employee services. And then there were eight, and then there were 12, and now there's close to 30. So it's sort of like you have another phone full of apps, but it's for everything that's supposed to help you manage your education, which on the one hand, that's supposedly more efficient and increases accessibility.
Right.
On the other hand, I think it's completely overwhelming for our students, for faculty too, but for students who have to juggle so much more. You know, email alone. I mean, the metastasis of email, like that's a taboo subject. You can't really mention that. Like, hey, maybe our students are getting too much email. You can't say that, but it's so true. And it's, I mean, so I see it both in those like really simple ways like email, but also in this really thorny, entangled way that the need for students to constantly be attending to these digital portals is just growing and growing and growing.
Down the steepest hill in town, trusted the world to hold me up, it always did. Cars stopping, dogs barking, I'm invincible. We spent hours hiding acorns for the squirrels. Wonder if they ever found them, or if they grew tiny forests in the hollow of red oak tree. If you had the chance to, would you trade it all, the lessons you've learned, for the peace of mind we had back then? Looking back, I know there was someone keeping me safe. May not have noticed, but I miss that feeling. I miss that feeling. That feeling, I miss that feeling.
I never wanted to teach online because as long as I've believed in college education, I have valued the social experience of sitting in a room together, or even better, outside, and learning with and from one another in person. It doesn't always work. There are uncomfortable silences. People fall asleep or freak out. Sitting together in a room is no guarantee that learning, or anything really, will happen the way it was planned.
Dreaming of the days when I could trust in anyone. The innocence in never knowing. The chaos and the light circles round us every night. Hold the worries of the world. It's not on your shoulders. Take this breath, hold my hand. We don't have to understand it now.
But I also think of higher education as a series of time-release capsules, and that they differ for everyone in terms of when their efficacy will occur. And so sometimes the most boring or awkward class will yield a lesson much later in life. This would likely not satisfy administrators who want to be able to assess outcomes directly after a class concludes and grades are filed. Teaching at a small liberal arts university as a tenured professor, I had the privilege to decide that I wouldn't teach online, even as demand for online courses increased. I taught rather boutique courses, and we had strong enrollments and a popular major. I knew that certain programs offered excellent online courses and degrees. Still, the vexing problem and opportunity of online learning was mostly an abstraction to me. It was something that bothered me, but from a distance.
If you had the chance to, would you trade it all, the lessons you learned, for the peace of mind we had back then? Looking back, I know there was someone keeping me safe. May not have noticed, but I miss that feeling.
Then, practically overnight, in March 2020, teaching online became what everyone was doing. We adapted.
If you had the chance to, would you trade it all, the lessons you learned, for the peace of mind we had back then?
I adapted. I used Google Docs for collaborative writing and discussions, and Zoom for group meetings. It helped at that point that I'd already gotten to know my students for nearly half the semester. So we could not just focus on keeping the formalities of our class going, but care about one another enough to check in and make sure that we were all surviving, as in actually surviving the novel coronavirus, and helping those infected survive when they were our family members or friends.
Looking back, I know there was someone keeping me safe. May not have noticed, but I miss that feeling. Looking back, I know there was someone keeping me safe.
It was a depressing haul, getting through the spring semester trying to keep a modicum of our courses alive, but we did it. The students learned things, reflected on what they'd learned, and even produced final projects. I never wanted to do that again, but it was also clear that online learning had finally claimed its rightful place at the helm of higher education. It wasn't going away, even after the pandemic.
And you even said that something's wrong and the depression was even starting before.
Yeah.
Is it that atomization of us and the move against the collective space?
Yeah, I think that puts it really well, actually. And that's why I think, you know, as much as this book was defined in the end by the pandemic, it was coming together beforehand for a couple of years beforehand. And it really was about that fragmentation and that feeling of losing the collective, collaborative, generative space of the classroom, which I'd always been able to count on in a way.
And you loved.
And I loved, yeah. And I still do. And it's not to say I didn't have like tough classes sometimes or there'd be arguments or debates. Well, yes, it was a gradual kind of interruption or fragmentation that then, I'm trying to word this carefully because that suddenness, it did happen before the pandemic, even though visibly the suddenness happened during the pandemic when we were teaching online. But that suddenness of feeling like, whoa, like we're all depressed. I definitely was picking up on that a good year before the pandemic. And it had to do with, you know, cultural tensions and people just being on a hairpin trigger for any number of issues that probably would come up in a critical humanities class.
I always told myself to find comfort in the uncomfortable. I always wanted to be brave. When it comes down to it, I start to get a little restless. When I'm scared, I look the other way.
At a certain point, it seemed like all my students were depressed. Or rather, it wasn't a certain point at all. It happened gradually and then suddenly, to borrow a line from Hemingway. This was depressing. It changed the feel of the classroom. It altered the possibilities of how we could learn together.
I felt the edge of my limits when I said I would. I pushed myself to feel alive. Sometimes I wonder how much can I handle. When it gets too much, I tend to hide.
Students became riddled with depression, anxiety, stress, and other widely diagnosed or even just felt maladies. And teachers were depressed by this situation in turn. We were all slogging through the hours, the days, the weeks, the terms, and the years with this crushing sense of something having gone wrong. We were supposed to be at the zenith of higher learning in a new century with urgent issues to confront and solve. Instead, it felt like each one of us was a little Sisyphus, pushing eternally at our phone screens.
I always told myself to find comfort in the uncomfortable. I always wanted to be brave. When it comes down to it, start to get a little restless. When I'm scared, I look the other way. I felt the edge of my limits when I said I would. I pushed myself to feel alive. Sometimes I wonder how much can I handle. When it gets too much, I tend to hide.
This is Jay Bradley Minnick. You're listening to Arts and Letters. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with teacher and writer Chris Schaeberg as he talks about his book, Pedagogy of the Depressed.
Ever since my first semester in college, there's something about this experience that has fascinated and inspired me. I live for the epiphany moments when students make a sudden breakthrough or when they connect things from different classes across disciplines, making connections we never anticipated.
I am a weaver, pulling out the threads, fixing things that you haven't seen quite yet. Your world feels like it's unraveling, thread by thread, the fabric loosening. I am a river, softening the sharpness, smoothing the stones, jagged edges, rough waters keep passing through. These are the times that will define you. Pictures hazy, fog on the river, we're still reaching for that. Change is never easy, but once you see it clearer, you'll be glad you changed.
There was always a palpable buzz about the classroom, the suspense of the first day of class, the midterm weeks when things were congealing and we've achieved a unique discussion dynamic, and the always bittersweet end of the semester when it's time for final presentations and students gush with admiration and pride at their cohort's achievements, and a little sadness for the fact that it's almost over.
And I really like this notion of inside-outside, or a kind of doubling moment. Bakhtin talks about a doubling moment where one is inside and outside at the same time, looking at something critically but inside of it. I do actually believe that, because I think that's a nexus for learning. You try to persuade anybody of anything and they can't really understand unless they've been inside of it. And we talk about inside and outside. Let's move to the outside just a little, because we've been kind of dealing with interiority and what that means and how it makes us feel, whether we're depressed or whether we're trying to work with it in our own atomized way. You make this wonderful move where you move to the outside when you talk about ecophobia. Would you tell the story about when you're reading the poem April and you take the students outside, and that poem is a little bit about it's about a bird, and that moment where the inside and the outside kind of come together in an odd juxtaposition?
Sure. Yeah, this was just a general education class, sort of the one required literature class that students take. So, you know, these are not English majors. And that week, this poem had published in The New Yorker.
Hello, my name is Sandra Simons, and I'll be reading my poem April, which was first published in the April 29th, 2019 issue of The New Yorker.
And I read it, and this is how often my reading assignments come about, I said, oh, this could be an interesting one to teach. And so we went outside, which we tend to do whenever we can for my classes, if it's nice out. And we We sat down in a little spot outside of the music building and we started reading this poem, which starts with a bird thumping on the ground. And right at that moment, we hear a bam above us.
The red bird falls from the tree.
And a sparrow falls, right, just a few feet away from our class.
Lands on its head, rolls right back up on its feet.
In real time, as we read these lines about a bird falling off a tree, and then the poem moves into a kind of cultural meditation on how our moment is very charged and fraught.
Hello, spring. Hello, sanity. Hello, trash fire century. Hello, wilted leaves and gothic vines. How are you doing today?
And we all looked at each other. We were like, did this just happen? And we watched the bird kind of curl up and die.
The yesterdays that you remember well hold the stories that still echo.
And we were just sort of so shocked. But for me, it was also like, this is amazing. This is what we're all here for. This is the world. Turned out we had to have a little burial ceremony for it after the class because it really disturbed a couple of the students. But, you know, I've always hated this notion that college isn't the real world. I'll hear, well, when you're out in the real world, you get it. And it's, to me, it's always like, this is as real as it gets. If you look at it the right way, if you treat it the right way, this is the real world too. But in that moment, it kind of made it vivid where, yep, this is the real world. We're reading a poem that's reflecting on this world. And here it is, you know, right at our feet. And now we have to deal with it and talk about this, not just as an abstract literary representation.
But it's something we've experienced.
Mm-hmm.
We're still reaching for that bigger picture. Change is never easy, but once you see it clearer, you'll be glad you changed.
Did we talk about that term, ecophobia?
Maybe you could just define it for me. I'd never heard that term.
Okay. Yeah, it actually comes from a literary scholar named Simon Estock, I think is his name. But it came to me from my colleague Hillary Eklund, and it happened one day after I taught a class outside, and I noticed that my students were just like visibly uncomfortable. They didn't want to sit in the grass, and they were like annoyed by the birds.
Oh, I get it.
And like some of my students saw like some lizards on the tree, and they were like, oh, lizards. And they were just like, they were just freaked out by the world. And I thought to myself, what is this? And so after class, I was walking by my colleague Hillary Eklund's office, and I said, Hillary, what's going on with our students? Have you noticed they're just not comfortable outside? And she's like, yeah, it's ecophobia. And I was like, huh. And she said, oh, yeah, check out this book by a colleague of hers in her field. And so I, you know, checked it out. And it's this notion that there's increasing anxiety and kind of paranoia around just sort of being outside in a sure. in a kind of like open, relaxed, non-goal-oriented way, right? It's one thing if you're just walking across the quad from the humanities building to the, you know, sciences building. That's one thing. But if you actually just have to linger there, mm-hmm. all these feelings start to come out. Mm-hmm. And so I just was kind of tuning into that and kind of experimenting with it in different classes. Like if we go outside, what's the vibe? How are the students responding to being outside? You know, I should just admit, I guess I'm kind of a nature person. I've had to just admit that and come to terms with that over the last few years. I think I fought it for a while.
Change is never easy, but once you see it clearer, you'll be glad you changed.
It's not just about me, not just about my discipline. It's not about a supposed crisis of the humanities. This is about a widespread erosion of belief in and practice of a liberal education, where students are expected not just to grudgingly check off a list of general requirements, but actually learn, maybe even enjoy learning, across a wide swath of subjects and disciplines. I'm starting to realize that for years I've been operating under the assumption that we valued this mode of higher learning, a kind of education that results in well-rounded people. Wasn't this our shared goal on some basic level?
I was always there. Weekends after five, when the sun went down, I drank coffee through the night. I want to make a difference when I'm not, I feel guilty. She says my smile doesn't reach my eyes anymore.
Professionalization and careerification of higher education is no secret. Schools worry about how they can guarantee a definitive return value to their students when they woo and recruit them. And to a certain extent, I am interested in this too. Our English department responded to this need directly by developing our Center for Editing and Publishing to give students hands-on experience in the real world. But that real world formulation has always bothered me. It's more like I'm trying to show my students that the work we do, writing, editing, publishing, marketing, is already real, and they are a part of it. The whole point of becoming well-rounded is precisely to be this way now and going forward.
I love this discussion. You write about it. The well-rounded student. My mother and I do this all the time, and she always says to me, "You used to be well-rounded." You were so well-rounded. You played sports and you did music, and all you do is work. Tell me about that idea of the well-rounded student, because I really enjoyed that section on the higher order thinking. Would you kind of flesh that out? And particularly in a world where intellectual inquiry is turning into a kind of mere data collection.
Yeah, I really continue to wrestle with this topic, because part of me looks at our core curriculum. You know, it's those, like, whatever, 15 classes that are across subject areas and disciplines, this spread of classes.
So like the core classes.
The core classes, right? And every university has their different version of it, and some are more lean and streamlined than others. And students complain about having to take that second science class or that second philosophy class or that second religious studies class or that second English class, right? And so I sometimes think to myself, you know what? We should just, like, totally streamline our core, make it easier for the students so that they can just take more of what they want to take. So, like, on the one hand, I want very minimalist core courses so that the students can take what they want and be well-rounded. Of course, that's assuming that they want to be well-rounded. The whole goal of a core is to create well-rounded students.
Exactly.
But if it's backfiring, if the students are just annoyed by the courses and just getting through them as fast as they can and not enjoying them, then that's, you know, it's counterproductive. So I wrestle with this, and I've been thinking a lot about how much do we believe in this notion in higher education broadly? Do we believe that part of our job is to make well-rounded students, to be well-rounded humans, or do we believe that the goal is really to make these highly professionalized, narrowly skilled students? And maybe these two things aren't, they're not exactly mutually exclusive, but there's certainly a lot of friction and tension between these models. It's not an exercise or a drill. It's what we're supposed to be by becoming this way. At least that's what I always thought. We still have a core curriculum, which resembles what many universities and the colleges require, a smattering of courses from across disciplines, from the sciences and the fine arts to the humanities and language courses. This is all fine and good, but when these courses are largely taught by contingent faculty to whom the university has shown no real long-term commitment, then the gradual effect is one of a cheap buffet of randomized classes which stand in for a well-rounded education. This is not to disparage any of the individual subjects or instructors that contribute to the core education, but rather to question the absolute bare minimum approach that so many institutions take to this allegedly central project of higher education.
I listened close when they said go the extra mile. Always be reachable and don't let us down. My eyes blurred staring at the same spreadsheet, with a heavy feeling that I'm losing. mind. I'm missing birthdays and high school graduations. Can I replace the things I lost along the way?
Instead of investing in faculty who will teach courses that students can build on, they scrimp for the easiest options to check off the boxes in order to pretend that they are educating well-rounded citizens. Because that's what this is about, isn't it? It's about becoming a citizen, about learning to see things from multiple perspectives, through different disciplinary angles and using different skill sets. It's about discovering new interests in places you didn't expect. It's about continuing to learn. And it's about starting this stuff in college, not waiting to be someone later.
These catch-all terms, you know, you said educating well-rounded, this is what it's all about, isn't it? Becoming a citizen.
Right.
Through different disciplinary angles, but it's vexed, right?
This is the vexed thing about general education or liberal arts requirements in college, though. They are ostensibly central to the mission, creating lifelong learners, well-rounded citizens, etc. And yet these very classes become the bane of everyone's existence. Tenured professors tend to avoid teaching intro-level or non-major courses if they can. And likewise, students tend to want to simply get through this stuff as fast as they can. If they can't pass out of it in the first place with advanced placement credit or the like, so we end up with a paradox. The alleged core of the learning experience ends up heartless.
Close when they said go the extra mile. Always be reachable, don't let us down. What matters most at the end of tomorrow? I'm just trying to find middle ground.
Kind of hopes for us. I would imagine you would hope we would move out of this depressive state.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a really difficult question because it's so structurally, systemically knotted, right? I mean, this is about, like, you know, social life, and this is about cultural institutions. And do we as a culture, you know, do we believe in higher education in a way that lets learning happen and learning kind of occur in ways that are often indeterminate or in ways that we just can't always map out? Is learning going to be this positivistic project where we always know the end goal and the result? Or can it be something that's more unpredictable, more generative, more inspiring? Obviously, the latter is what I try for and what I would like to see more institutions rally around. But these sort of more amorphous, I guess, humanistic goals really run hard into the kind of technological utopia, dystopia that's being more and more ingrained into our daily life as educators.
So as we move into the unknown, Chris, and, you know, as you kind of quote, the paradoxical complicity between teaching and unknowing is not without hazards. What keeps you going?
The simplest answer is my students. My students continue to keep me going, even when I'm in, like, just awful committee meetings that are getting nowhere at best, or being just burdened by various assessment measures or budgetary difficulties, or not being able to hire new colleagues, all the things that get me down. I can still go into the classroom and get inspired by my students.
There's a better day ahead. We'll find the answers we've been searching for but missing. There's a new song breaking dawn. The key to hearing it is just to listen.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Thank you to Ashton Barbary and Lacey Hampton for writing our theme song, High Hopes, performed by Corey McElvey, Ashton Barbary, and Lacey Hampton. Thank you to the amazing Ashton Barbary, who created all of the music for this program, including the theme song and the beautiful soundscapes and heartfelt songs that allow us to cry and then pick us up again.
If you had the chance to, would you trade it all, the lessons you've learned, for the peace of mind we had back then? Looking back, I know there was someone keeping me safe.
Thank you to Sandra Simons for reading her beautiful poem, April. Thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt for the story editing advice. Thank you to my first sound teacher, Mr. Chris Hickey, for helping to mix and for mastering the episode. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to professor and writer Chris Schaeberg for reading and writing our world in light of rapidly evolving pedagogy placed side by side with its past and potential future. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Paulo Freire. Whoever teaches, learns in the act of teaching, and whoever learns, teaches in the act of learning.
I miss that feeling. I miss that feeling.
This show is dedicated to Dr. Michael Klein, one of the best professors, teachers I've ever known. Arts and Letters is a production of Living the Dream Media.